Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Greta Anderson, together with Belinda Merritt. Hi, Belinda.
Hello, Greta, and hello to you, the listener.
We've got a very exciting show today. Later in the hour, Cynthia McClure will be by with bringing us her interview with a local Wiccan woman who is undergoing training to become a Wiccan priest. This Liz Rorrit, her guest, will... And at the end of the hour, we'll have you, Belinda, interviewing... We have a special musical guest.
Yes, I'll be speaking with Fred Love, a local musician. He is the lead singer for the Colt Walkers, which is basically a country band. And then later, I will be giving the live music information for this weekend and the week to come.
And so your guest will be playing a tune for us?
Yes, he will. He'll be playing an original song entitled Last Time Around, I Swear. He'll be performing that live with his guitar.
Right here in our studio. For now, we've got our first topic on the docket right now is a guest, Philip McMichael, who spoke to a large crowd this Tuesday at the ISU Memorial Union on the topic of the politics of global food security. And we heard Vandana Shiva giving us the top of the hour a station ID, and this was kind of a continuation of some of those ideas that she presented to the ISU community. Food security is basically the amount of safeguards to make sure that people don't go hungry. And Philip McMichael, a sociology professor at Cornell University, represents peasant farmer movements at the level of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, headquartered in Rome. These farmers are arguing that the best way to prevent hunger is to protect their right to stay on the land and grow food, as they have done for decades, if not centuries. This is in contrast to another view, the view of the philanthropist Bill Gates and many researchers, even here at ISU, who believe that Western crops and Western expertise is what is going to save the world from hunger. So, in fact, the FAO, this Food and Agriculture Organization that is part of the UN, did not have this representation of peasant groups, forest dwellers, and indigenous people until very recently. The global food crisis of 2007 and 2008 sort of forced the UN to consider this large source of food grown by peasant farmers. So, Belinda, did you know that there was a global food crisis in 2007 and 2008?
Oh, well, I'd heard something about it, but I really don't have that much information.
Yeah, I'm ashamed to say that I really didn't hear much about it myself or know about it. I suppose most of our country during those years was focused on our elections, an exciting new candidate that we were following. And then there was, of course, the real estate bubble, the gas rates going up. But there was a global food crisis in 2007 and 2008. And here's Philip McMichael, professor of sociology at Cornell University, explaining its origins.
Basically, food prices spiked in those years. And two things happened. One is that there were a lot of food riots around the world where hungry urbanites came out and protested against their government's food policies. And secondly, the big grain exporters, Russia, India, Vietnam, etc., put export bans on so that they could keep food for their own populations and they weren't now exporting to the world market. And of course, that meant that there was less grain on the world market and prices, you know, kept moving up. So there was a kind of conjunction of that process, and then with the biofuels interest, which had emerged earlier during the 2000s, that began to have an impact also. And in fact, the World Bank estimated that the biofuel issue was responsible for 65% of the inflated prices of food in 2007-2008. I think that's a little bit over inflated. I think it's more like about 45%. That's a better estimate. But still, it's a very significant impact that the biofuel initiatives had on world food prices. There was an energy crisis insofar as oil prices went up at the same time. And so there was a conjunction of energy, food, and financial crisis on top of the recognition that climate crisis was also something that the world was facing. And so it was a very important conjuncture in which some very important decisions had to be made and still have to be made.
As most of our listeners are aware, the biofuel initiative in the United States, the so-called renewable fuel standard, which sets target amounts of biofuel to be used each year and that those target amounts grow over the years, receives a lot of support in our state from Iowa politicians and from politicians visiting Iowa because it is such a strong support for corn prices. So again, the topic of Dr. McMichael's lecture was global food security, how to keep the world's masses from going hungry. I asked Dr. McMichael where the notion of Iowa farmers and Midwest farmers feeding the world came from. He dated it to the early 1950s when American agriculture really did feed the starving Europeans still struggling to recover from the effects of the war. And this notion was reinforced in the 1970s when Russia faced food shortages and opened its markets to us. That's when Ag Secretary Earl Butz, Nixon's Ag Secretary, told Iowa farmers to get big or get out. And that's about where we'll pick up the story with Dr. McMichael.
About a decade later, with the competition between the Europeans and the Americans to open up markets for their food commodities in the Third World, there was a need to try and regulate this competition, and the Uruguay Round was established. And at the Uruguay Round, the United States came along and argued that the food security now was about opening up the world market for a free trade regime, and that food security would now be the ability to buy food. And of course, the problem with this concept is that not everybody participates in the market. Only about 40-45% of the world has access to cash and credit to participate in the market. And so it doesn't make sense to build a concept of food security around producing simply for the market, because that food is not going to get to the hungry people who are living primarily in the rural areas or in slums, who don't have the means to purchase that food.
And you mentioned that the goal of having people purchase food mm-hmm. has shifted now, especially in your group. They're talking about the right to grow food.
Right.
And
right.
These people don't necessarily participate in the market. As you say, they grow food for mm-hmm. their own consumption.
Well, it's important, I think, to emphasize that there are two different scales of markets. There's the world market, which is fully monetized and organized by institutions like the World Trade Organization and managed by large corporations that move food across the world, and retailers, of course. And then there are local markets, and many of those local markets are the markets to which local food producers distribute the food that they're producing in addition to the food that they're consuming for themselves. So it's one thing to talk about the ability to buy food as the definition of food security on the global market. It's another thing to recognize that the majority world lives outside of the global markets that we participate in, and they're producing food as much as they can to feed their families and to provide for local markets. So the movements, the social movements in Rome, are really pushing for the right for those people to produce food and not to be drawn into value chains to produce food for the global market, and not to be pushed off the land or resettled because it's profitable for financiers and governments like China, South Korea, Japan, and the Middle Eastern countries to actually invest in land offshore in places like Africa or Latin America. And so we have a real problem there of feeding the world through the global market, which doesn't reach the people who don't participate in the global market, and at the same time dispossessing the producers in local regions of the land they need to sustain their livelihoods and the reproduction of their own communities.
You mentioned a very interesting statistic in your talk of how much of the food production in the world is by smallholder farms.
Yes, it's up to 70% of the world's food is actually produced by small-scale producers. And this is a statistic that one finds in different organizations who've studied this process. And basically, it's arguing that small farmers on the land, as well as forest dwellers, as well as urban gardening, account for 70% of the world's food production and only 30% comes from industrial agriculture. I'm not sticking to that, to those statistics rigidly. It could be more like 60-40, but the point is that the majority of the world's food is actually still produced by small scale producers. And it's very easy to forget that, and to assume that small scale producers are not efficient, that they're not productive and so forth. But what we're doing there is imposing an economic definition of what productivity is against a population, which is a majority population who live in rural areas and depend on the land for their livelihood.
Yeah, you mentioned a lot of other services that the smallholder farmers provide, mm-hmm. as well as producing food.
Right. Well, that's a good point. I think one of the things about the large scale intensive agriculture that we see, say, in Iowa is essentially capital intensive agriculture, and there's very little labor that goes into the production of that kind of large scale food system. And what we often forget is that the majority world are laborers, and that their investment in their land is labor investment. It's not financial investment. And that labor is also labor that's very skilled. It's based on long traditions of knowledge about the local spaces, about the local ecologies, about the local weather patterns, about seed use to avert risk, and all of those kinds of things. And so it's very important, I think, for us to recognize that we live in a culture where labor is not valued. But in fact, the majority world still value their farm labor, and that farm labor has all kinds of benefits, and that is, first of all, providing jobs in rural areas. Secondly, potentially working to steward the land so that ecosystems can be protected and regenerated. Thirdly, providing an aesthetic where you have diverse landscapes as opposed to single monocrop landscapes. Those are the kinds of multifunctional activities that small farming communities can provide.
You mentioned value chains. What does that mean?
Well, value chains are really commodity chains, and it basically means that a farmer can enter into a contract with a company who guarantees a market for what the farmer produces in return for upfront credit, upfront seeds, upfront fertilizer, and so forth that the farmer may receive from that company. And so the relationship, the contract relationship, is part of a commodity chain where the farmer is producing a foodstuff, say, that then is passed on to a processor, and then that's passed on to a retailer and sold mostly in the global market. And so it's a long supply chain that connects the farmer, the producer, if you like, in one part of the world to consumers in another part of the world. And the issue there is that value chains produce value, and at the present time, because these value chains are organized by large-scale agribusinesses or retailers, the bulk of the value actually ends up in the hands of those companies, and not in the hands of the farmers who actually produce the foods. And the other issue about value chains that's really important is that because the farmers are being provided with all of the agro inputs and the instructions about how to produce the food, their farming is being de-skilled, and basically they're becoming a laborer on their own land as opposed to a farmer who makes his or her own decisions about what's to be produced, how it's to be produced, and how to take care of the land and the ecosystem in which it's being produced.
De-skilled is the word you used.
Yes. And by farming skills, I mean skills that are associated with taking notice of the particularities of the landscape, the particularities of soil and water cycles and what have you. And all of these things are very much related to place. They're not taken into account in the large-scale operations because those large-scale operations are essentially replicated across space, and they don't take into account the particularities of space.
It's a one-size-fits-all type
yes,
model.
Yes, that's right.
So you represent these smallholder farmers in many countries in the world, and I'm curious what kind of pressures they feel on the ground. I mean, don't they have the right to say we want to plant what we choose to plant, and how do these other pressures come to bear on them?
I think I would just say there are three particular pressures that have taken place in the last three or four decades. Firstly, the supports that the governments have provided in the post-colonial period to these small farmers have disappeared largely because of structural adjustment and the need for countries to reduce their budgets and to tighten their belts, etc. Secondly, I mentioned the onslaught of cheap food that is being dumped in these markets, which undermine the capacity of local farmers to survive and compete in local markets. And the interesting point there is that Iowa exports quite a bit of corn into Mexico, and small farmers in Mexico find it very difficult to compete with these large supplies of corn that are being dumped in the Mexican market. And so some of them end up losing their land and having to move on and coming across the border and working on American farms. It's quite ironic to think about that circular process. So that's the second impact. And then the third pressure that small farmers are feeling is now the land grab, where increasingly financiers and countries through sovereign wealth funds are investing in purchasing and renting land offshore in Africa, Southeast Asia, in Latin America in particular, also in Australia, my country, investing in land offshore to ensure that those countries have access to food production and biofuel production in the event that the world market enters another crisis like it did in 2007, 2008. And at the same time, the financiers who are investing in land offshore have no knowledge of farming. And so agriculture is becoming essentially an abstraction. It's just another investment arena to maintain financial solvency. And unfortunately, the land that is being taken away from the farmers who traditionally use the land is being used for plantations of monocrops, primarily biofuels at this point. And unfortunately, it's forcing small farmers to lose access to their own lands. And this is happening because, particularly in Africa, where most land is owned by the state, governments are able to enter into deals with financiers to indeed take land away from communities. Often, of course, they'll make deals to resettle those populations, but any farmer knows that to be moved off the land and plonked down somewhere else doesn't exactly amount to being compensated in an appropriate way.
Our concept of owning the land is a little different in other countries.
The point there is that these are very different cultures where land is essentially occupied by communities and they've had customary rights to use the land. But now, with the expansion of the global market, there's a lot more pressure for governments to give in to our understanding of how land should be owned and used for commercial production as opposed to being used for local production for the sustainability of rural communities.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Well, thanks, Greta. I think the last thing I would just say is that this issue of how to organize and reorganize agriculture to survive the future, which is a future of climate crisis and a future of ecological degradation, and these have all been very well documented, is it's very difficult to talk about, well, how do we reorganize agriculture? And I think the place I would start there is the place I work at in Rome, and that is, first of all, it's really important to recognize that we have over 2 billion people living on the land across the world whose livelihood depends on having access to land. And so, first of all, protecting their rights to stay on the land and produce food for themselves and for local populations is really a bottom line. That's one thing. The other thing is that we have a lot to learn from those producing communities because they know about ecological agriculture. They know about how to use local seeds to avert risk. They have knowledges that we could certainly learn from. And the more we reduce our genetic diversity, the more vulnerable we come as a species. So that's where I start. And as for the larger questions of what should large scale producers, agricultural producers do? Well, of course, the more that they can shift towards a much more multifunctional ecological form of farming, the healthier we'll all be. And the more we stop thinking that we can feed the world simply with large scale agriculture, we'll be in a better place to think about what's an appropriate, more rational, ecological form of farming to survive the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Philip McMichael of Cornell University in New York, active in the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, which is headquartered in Rome, on behalf of smallholder farmers. Many thanks to Gabrielle Rush McNally, a graduate student in sustainable agriculture and rural sociology, who made the interview possible. Gabrielle first encountered Dr. McMichael's work in a sociology class, where she read an article of his that talked about how biofuel initiatives had in part caused the global food crisis that we started off this segment with. And here's her description of her response to that awakening.
It was hard to sort of learn about that and recognize, oh, I'd always been very supportive of biofuels. I've become more critical. But I would just mention that I work a lot with farmers in Iowa and the Midwest, and a lot of them, you know, have worked really hard to survive in a increasingly sort of globalized marketplace that has not always served the interest of even what we would call sort of industrial producers in the Midwest. You know, a lot of them lost out in the 80s and this sort of getting bigger or get out sort of mentality. And those who've been able to stay in it have survived because they've, you know, followed the sort of incentives that have been brought down by federal government and by industry. So it's hard to sort of paint biofuels sort of in this negative light without sort of recognizing that it's this very complex storyline. But I wish that we could just have more of a conversation about that. Again, it's this notion I think a lot of people who are promoting them because they want to preserve agriculture in the Midwest, which I think is an honorable thing, but often it misses this complexity and this nuance. So how can we expand that conversation?
So I really like what Gabrielle said. And though we do not have the time to bring in others into this conversation today, I hope to come back to the topic of global food security in future local talk shows. It's an ironic insight of hers that both groups of farmers here in Iowa and there in the global South that Dr. McMichael represents have as their first objective, staying on the land.
My darling, stand by me. No matter who you are, no matter where you go in life, you gonna need somebody to stand by you. No matter how much money you got,
you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm one of your hosts today, Greta Anderson, together with Belinda Merritt and Cynthia McClure. We would like to remind everyone that we're having a fun drive, and I'm not exactly sure whether that's a fun drive or a fund drive coming up in the next couple weeks. Our goal is to have fun and also to raise money. And so we will be producing local talk shows for the 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. hours, original local talk shows for all of those, just guests coming in and out of our doors, making things interesting here at the station. So please tune in the last week of April and hear all of that good stuff. Next up, we've got Belinda Merritt, our correspondent for music, local and live. And she's got a guest with a great name and a guitar in his hand. So I'll turn it over to you, Belinda.
Yes, thank you, Greta. Here with me today is local musician Fred Love. And Fred is the lead singer for the Colt Walkers, which is basically a country band, but they also play what is known as roots rock or Americana music. Welcome, Fred.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Would you like to tell us a little about your band and maybe just briefly about its members?
Yeah, we're a four-piece band composed of guys who all live in Ames. So Greg Bruna plays bass and Dave Acheson plays drums. Ryan Moritz is a very talented multi-instrumentalist. He plays mandolin and keys and harmonica, and he does some singing. And then I play guitar and sing as well.
Would you say your music is more easy listening, or is it the kind of music that people like to dance to?
We definitely encourage dancing and rowdy behavior in various ways. I think we've got too many rough edges to be considered easy listening. You know, we play a lot of acoustic instruments, but we like to make them rock at the same time.
So are you saying that you have a lot of interaction with your audiences when you do your shows?
Yeah, we try to. We try to let people know that if they want to clap their hands or stomp their feet or dance or whatever ails you, that's always what we say. We just want folks to have a good time. We try to be warm and welcoming and inclusive and maybe a little goofy and just create a positive, fun atmosphere.
It does sound like fun. From what I've been told, the Colt Walkers will be performing at two different shows in our area this weekend. Would you like to tell me about your upcoming shows?
Yeah, absolutely. So we just put out an album called Trail of Blood and Broken Hearts, and so we're playing a lot of shows to promote it and get it out there. So tonight we're playing at Woolies in Des Moines, and then tomorrow night we're playing a Nova Labs showcase at DG's Tap House. No tickets necessary for either show.
Oh, so everyone's welcome then.
Yep.
No tickets are necessary.
Absolutely.
That sounds great. Will both of these shows be basically the same, or will you have different material at each one?
The Woolly set is going to be a little longer. So just about every song on our album is going to get played at either show. We'll have some extra originals and some extra covers for the longer set tonight at Woolly's. But it's going to be more or less, you know, I think people, when they come to a Colt Walker show, they know that we're gonna be fun and we're gonna rock and hopefully just help everyone have a good time.
Can you explain the name of your band, the Colt Walkers?
Yeah, absolutely. The name Colt Walkers comes from a pistol, a large revolving pistol that Samuel Colt developed, I think in like 1847, the middle of the 1800s. And I think it was originally designed for military purposes, but it became kind of popular with cowboys in the West. And my first exposure to a Colt Walker pistol was actually the character Gus McRae in the movie Lonesome Dove, which is like my all-time favorite cowboy movie. And so when I was a little kid, my favorite character was Gus, and he'd walk around with this beautiful, huge pistol in his holster, and so I had to know what it was and figure it out, and that's where the name of the band comes from, the Colt Walker pistol.
And what about you, Fred? What is your background, and have you always wanted to be in a band?
So I'm originally from Northeast Iowa, a really small town called Quasquin. It's about 550 people in Northeast Iowa in Buchanan County, so very rural upbringing. And I think that definitely has influenced my idea of music and what goes into good music. So I listened to a lot of country and a lot of folk and acoustic music growing up. But you know, at the same time, I think I have always wanted to be in a band, at least since I figured out that was something that real people could do. I think when I was a kid, I had this idea that only rock stars, you know, made records and played music, but As I grew older, I sort of got the idea that, you know, anyone can do it. You just, if you're determined and you find the right group of people, it's something that most anyone can do.
So how does it feel to be a rock star? I mean, really, what's it like when you're up there on the stage?
Oh, I don't know if I would ever, I don't really even like the idea of thinking of myself as a rock star, but playing live music with a group of guys that I really enjoy spending time with, it's an adrenaline rush, and it's like this feeling that we're all sort of maybe telepathically connected. We're all on the same page. We know the songs really well, and we just have a really good time playing together. So it's a great feeling, something that I don't get any other way.
So how did you get together? How did your band form?
So I lived in Washington, D.C. for a few years after I graduated from Iowa State. And then when I moved back, I knew I'd kind of want to get involved with the local music scene again. So I was playing open mics, mostly with songs that I'd written. And Ryan was at a couple of those open mics, and he was at an early solo show that I played. And he said, "Hey, I think we've got a lot of musical ground in common. I play a lot of different instruments. Why don't we jam together sometime?" So that was kind of the nucleus. And then we recruited Greg and Dave as the rhythm section, and they brought sort of a more of a rock and roll feel to the band, and that's where we've been ever since.
Well, so how long have you been together?
About a little over 3 years now. I think our first show was here at the Pantorium in February of 2012, so three years ago.
Yeah, so it's been a while then.
Yeah.
And you did mention that you recently released a new album. Is this your first album or is it one of...
Yep, it is. It's our first album. It's been a long time coming. We spent about a year recording it and working on it, polishing it. We recorded and mixed it here in town at Alexander Recording Company. Dennis Hazlip was the recording engineer, did a great job, and we're really proud of how it sounds.
And do you write your own material?
Yep, all 9 songs on the album are originals. For 8 of those 9 songs, I wrote the lyrics and the vocal melodies and the chord changes. But, you know, everyone brings their own creativity to the songs. I don't tell them how to play their instruments, so they write their own parts for their instruments. And so, you know, we think of the songs as Colt Walker originals.
Great. I understand that you're going to be performing one of your original songs for us today. I see that you've brought your guitar.
Yeah.
So I'll introduce you, ladies and gentlemen. This will be Fred Love of the Colt Walkers performing an original song entitled Last Time Around, I Swear.
All right, thank you.
La 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 la. Stronger men than me have fallen down the hill. Wiser men than me have gotten lost. So here I am again, begging pardon and peace, knowing all too well what it cost. I'm sorry that I never get it right, Mama. I'm sorry that I never get nowhere. I'm sorry I was led into that wretched bed. It's the last time around, I swear. La 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 la. Met that bohemian girl when I had too much to drink. She was taking in the music on the street. She knew every word to your cheating heart, and I was hers when she sang it to me. I'm sorry that I never get it right, Mama. I'm sorry that I never get nowhere. I'm sorry I was led into that wretched bed. It's the last time around, I swear. La 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 la. Been dancing with these demons for way too many nights. I've been lying to myself so darn long. I'm a man of weakness, but when I make you cry, how I wish so darn bad I was strong. I'm sorry that I never get it right, Mama. I'm sorry that I never get nowhere. I'm sorry I was led into that wretched bed. It's the last time around, I swear. La 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 la.
Thank you.
And thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for being here today.
It's my pleasure.
And you're heading off to work.
Yep, heading off to work, and then I got the gigs tonight.
He's wearing his ISU shirt. So we are moving on, I guess, to a new topic. Thanks for being here, Fred.
Thank you for having me, guys. My pleasure.
And Cynthia McClure is in the studio with us. Cynthia has been providing a lot of content for us from Liz Rorit, who is – why don't you describe
– Well, I interviewed Liz before the events that occurred on April 9th at the State House. So this was all prior to the – in the event, but the Iowa State House tradition dictates an opening invocation to be held at the beginning of each day of session. But recently, the focus shifted from the traditional Judeo-Christian belief to include its first invocation given by a Wiccan. Wiccan priestess Deborah Maynard of Cedar Rapids stood at the podium in the Iowa State House Chamber on April 9th and gave her invocation. More than half of the 100 House Iowa House representatives were not present for this opening invocation. Several lawmakers came in late to avoid the event. One turned his back in protest, while others made it a point to boycott the event because of their views regarding pagans and Wiccan beliefs. Representative Liz Bennett, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, who invited Maynard to offer the invocation, has known her for years. Bennett considers the House chamber to be a place that should be open to everyone, adding that she has also invited two Christian pastors, a Jewish rabbi, who has offered daily invocations in the House. When we say, and here's a quote from her, "When we say we believe in religious freedom, we believe in religious liberty. That means that we don't endorse one religion over another as a government." Connie Ryan Terrell, executive director of the Interfaith Alliance of Iowa, said she applauded Bennett for inviting Maynard and bringing a breath of diversity to the capital of Iowa. "Like it or not, our legislators have a long-standing tradition of opening their session with prayer and a brief meditation. And the only real stipulation is that it be respectful to other religious beliefs. A person who is a Wiccan has every right to provide a prayer at the request of a legislator. Quite simply, it is disingenuous for some legislators and conservative religious groups to create a public outcry against a minority religion when they often cry wolf about their own religious rights being under assault."
Who is that quote from?
That quote is from Connie Ryan Terrell, executive director of the Interfaith Alliance of Iowa, and it was from the Des Moines Register regarding this story on April 9th. So, and Wiccan is a pagan faith that stresses the interconnectedness of the cosmos and a spiritual relationship with nature. It is considered a diverse religion with no central authority. Many Wiccans believe in magic. Maynard, who did the invocation, works as a project manager for an Eastern Iowa business and is the leader of a covenant of the Unitarian Universalist Pagans in Cedar Rapids. Maynard is apparently the third pagan in the United States to lead an opening prayer or invocation at a state house. And I did an interview prior to this with Elizabeth Rarrett talking about her beliefs. She is a local Ames, Iowa pagan and also Wiccan. And she's, she is going currently to Circle Sanctuary to, become an ordained minister for this, religious group.
Great. Let's listen to that interview.
Liz Rarrett. She is a minister in training at Circle Sanctuary. You want to explain what Circle Sanctuary is to our listening audience here in Central Iowa?
Gladly. Circle Sanctuary is one of the older Wiccan and neo-pagan churches in North America. It was founded about 40 years ago. In fact, they just had their 40th anniversary this past Samhain or Halloween. And they have a variety of ministries going on, including they have about 100 acres of land up in Wisconsin, just west of Madison, that they are converting back into native prairie, native woodland. They also have prison ministry, a military ministry, a legal ministry called the Lady Liberty League, which is for pagans and Wiccans who are having legal difficulty on account of their religion.
So this is legal difficulty in, mm-hmm. in what kind of situation, like school system?
All of the above. Here in Iowa, about 10 years ago, a couple had their children taken away because they were Wiccan, and DHS took exception to that.
Can you explain what Wiccan is to our listening audience? Because some people may know mm-hmm. and may be aware of that community, and others may just think it's something really bad.
Certainly. Certainly. Well, the umbrella term is paganism, and it's like the equivalent of saying you have Christianity, and then under Christianity you have your Catholics and your Methodists. So the umbrella term for us is pagans. And that includes a variety of native spiritualities that are native to Europe, to Africa, to basically it includes all of your sort of native spiritualities. And it also includes modern spiritualities such as Wicca. Wicca is a religion that was founded in the 1900s by Gerald Gardner in England. And he intended it as a recreation of native British traditions that he merged with stuff that he had learned from Freemasonry as well as the Order of the Golden Dawn.
Okay, when you say native belief systems, you're talking pre-Christian belief systems, pre-Catholicism.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. The spiritualities that existed in a place before other religions, especially Christianity, but also like Islam or Judaism or
basically pre-Roman belief systems, so before the conquerors came
in. Absolutely. So those traditions still exist in a lot of like folk tales, folk practices, things like, you know, decorating trees at Christmas time. What does that have to do with Jesus? Not a heck of a lot, to be honest with you. It's a survival that the Christmas tree is a survival of a pre-Christian belief in trees being incarnations of ancestors that you would decorate and give offerings to.
So you take the myths that survived in pre-Christian beliefs that piggybacked on in Catholicism that don't make sense in Judeo-Christian culture. I mean, they just don't follow the Bible.
Correct.
And you find the links with those and build a structure to that.
Exactly. Exactly. And we take a lot of the writings of, for example, a lot of those cultures did not have a written tradition like Judaism does. So it was all oral tradition, and some of that stuff got written down later by Christian monks, especially like the Venerable Bede, or even Julius Caesar wrote a great deal about the practices of the Druids. Now, obviously, these people have lenses.
Was it Pliny the Elder or the Younger or something like that?
One of them, yes. Yeah. I can never keep them straight. But they obviously had some lenses to what they were looking at, and they interpreted it according to their experience. And so sometimes you have to take what they wrote with a grain of salt.
This takes a lot of scholarship, actually, to try to figure out what existed.
Yes.
So why are you doing this? It seems like a lot of effort. I mean, a lot of effort to go to figure out what our ancestors were doing.
Well, partially because I'm a history nerd. Always have been, always will be. I grew up in a history nerd family. My dad and mom's honeymoon consisted of going to Civil War battle sites.
Oh, romantic.
Very. But it's also that these beliefs have a lot of merit to them.
Okay.
There's a lot of practices that were done by our ancestors that got lost or thrown away that did us some good, that built community, that led us to a spiritual place where we were more at one with the natural world as opposed to having dominion over it.
Okay, so instead of coming as the conquerors, you're coming as co-inhabitants.
Correct.
What about those people that are listening or listening audience and that, you know, think all of it is hokum, you know, that what you have to share is destructive because of what they believe, what they've been taught, what they know from, you know, sitting on the knee saying, you know, witches are bad or something, you know, just negative and fear for that fear. What would you want to address to the listening audience?
Well, always remember, we have a saying in paganism, where there's fear, there's power. If you have fear, then someone has power over you. You know, there's different ways to overcome fear. And in our religion, we talk about fear openly. It's all of our emotions have a power. They're like little batteries that can either power us to do something good or something bad. And whichever way you choose, exactly, your intention determines that. So if you're experiencing fear, number one, just acknowledge that you're experiencing it.
It's a very Buddhist mindset, actually.
I know. It is very Buddhist. Acknowledge that you're feeling fear and then acknowledge why. Is it the word, you know, pagan or witch or Wicca or whatever? and why, where does that fear come from? And then once, when you're aware of your fear, be willing to just set it aside long enough to listen.
So put your judgment aside.
Correct.
Acknowledge what you're feeling. That's kind of hard.
That's hard.
That's an adult thing to do. And sometimes these fears come, for me, they come from a very early place. And it's like, I thought they were there to protect me, but sometimes they're not necessarily protection for me.
Definitely. All of our emotions serve a purpose. Fear does serve a purpose. Fear is good in that it tells you something's wrong, but you can't stay there. That's staying in fear is a child's response. It's being afraid of the thing under the bed. I acknowledge that I am afraid. And, you know, if I'm meeting someone and I know that they're very into their religion and they're going to look down on me because of my religion, always keep in mind that we're all human beings.
Mm-hmm.
We all have the same motivations. We all, you know, want to have a good and prosperous life. We all want to have a good and healthy family. We have jobs. We pay taxes. By and large, we're pretty much exactly the same. It's just that when we talk to God, we call her goddess.
So it's a feminine aspect.
A lot of it is. Wicca specifically, which is my denomination, if you will, of paganism, acknowledges the divine in multiple aspects, but the primary one is the goddess.
So the pronoun has changed.
Correct. And that's done deliberately for a reason. Instead of, you know, only acknowledging the masculine aspects of the divine, which have gotten way too much emphasis for the last 2,000 years, we like to emphasize the feminine aspects of the divine to say that women are sacred, that that which is female is also sacred. We're not saying that the men are any less. We're just saying, okay, guys, you've been the dominant aspect of the religion party here for a while. Let's have a little balance by giving the lady her due.
So do you find that Wiccan women are empowered?
Absolutely. That was one of the most wonderful things when I became Wiccan when I was about 16. One of the most empowering things was that there is a goddess. She looks like me. She's part of me. And that was so deeply empowering. I can almost just not, I mean, words are failing.
So how do you get involved with that? I mean, you were Midwestern religious family. Did you just like lift up a rock or go to the library and find a book, or where did this
sort
occur?
Of. Yeah, well, sort of. Interesting things happened. One thing that I discovered about myself before all this was that anytime someone said that is bad or evil or scary, I wanted to know more about it, because I knew on an intuitive level that if they were scared of something, I wanted to know why. I wanted to know what was scary about that. What was the reason? And was that reason valid? I always had a
So that historian, question. That scholar, that intellectual aspect. That
right.
You were real curious.
I was super curious. And so one time I was in a bookstore and had wandered into the metaphysical section, and my grandmother came to fetch me, and I had just picked up a book about Celtic magic, and she was like, oh, that's just stories. You need to put that away, and we're leaving now. And so, of course, I went, bing! What was that response about, you know?
Because she was afraid then.
She was afraid. And I understand that. I understand that. My mother is also very afraid for me. She's very, very determined, shall we say, in her attempts to try and convert me back to Christianity.
Why is that? Do you think people will try to harm you or
well, that
harm,
too.
You know, because there's,
that's a risk.
There's a long history of witches and even pagans being burned at the stake.
Very much so. And it continues today in various forms. People lose their jobs. People lose their children in divorce proceedings when their ex says, oh, she's into witchcraft or something. People get bricks thrown through their windows in this day and age. Like last year, a friend of mine in Florida had bricks thrown through her windows because she was a pagan children's book author. You know, and they never caught the people that did that. There's an open circle, a little area set aside at the Air Force Academy in Colorado that has been desecrated with spray paint and stuff like that.
How can you, during this short time, try to enlighten people?
Just by being public, by answering, by coming in and doing programs at KHOI, by doing interviews, by making myself available.
That was Elizabeth Rarrett. I interviewed her prior to the State House April 9th invocation by a Wiccan priestess. And Liz was really nice enough to come in, and we had that conversation. And I just took an excerpt of an hour and a half long conversation with her about her belief system. And there's a lot more to the story. And she is a very nice person. And we have Belinda Merritt talking about the music for this weekend.
Yes, thank you. I have the live music for April 17th through the 23rd. Today, Friday, April 17th, David Zalo and the Body Electric will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main Street. Tiny Moving Parts with Pelvis will be at the Maintenance Shop in ISU's Memorial Union. Brad Myers Band will be at Mother's Pub, 2900 West Street. Casey Musicman will be at Crossroads Tavern, 1790 Giddings Street in Cali. J. Clyde Band will be at The Bar, 823 Wheeler Street. On Saturday, April 18th, Split Lip Rayfield with Mr. Baber's Neighbors will be at Blue Stem, formerly Zeke's, at 3329 Lincoln Way at 8 o'clock p.m. This is a show for all ages, and tickets are available at eventbrite.com. The Colt Walkers with Beefcake, Disco Dick, Great Caesar's Goat, and Jeff DeWitt will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main Street. Last in Line will be at The Bar, 823 Wheeler Street. Viva Shea will be at Crossroads Tavern, 1790 Giddings Street in Cali. Matt Hires with My Red and Blue will be at the Maintenance Shop in ISU's Memorial Union. Stacy Peterson will be at Taking It Easy Lounge, 129 Lincoln Way. On Sunday, April 19th, Cool Blue will be at Snoof's Hill Winery in Madrid. Wednesday, April 22nd, The Accidentals with Triggerfish and Sen Shrog will be at Blue Stem, formerly Zeke's, 3329 Lincoln Way at 8 o'clock p.m. This is a show for all ages, and tickets are available at eventbrite.com. On Thursday, April 23rd, Esme Patterson will be at the Maintenance Shop in ISU's Memorial Union. Jordan Carr and the boys will be at DG's Tap House, 125 Main Street. That's all I have for this week. Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I would like to thank our guests today. Greta had an interview with Philip McMichael, a sociology professor at Cornell University. She interviewed Gabriel Rush McNally, a graduate student in sustainable agriculture and rural sociology here at Iowa State University. Our very own Belinda Merritt, who you just heard, interviewed Fred Love, a local musician in a band. What was that band's name again?
Colt Walkers.
He played live here in our studio last time around, I swear. And I would also like to thank Elizabeth Rarrett, Wiccan minister in training from Circle Sanctuary, and for sharing what it is and it means to her to be a Wiccan. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop, as well as a radio show. If you would like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. And, of course, you're always welcome to drop by our studios here in downtown Ames at 410 Douglas. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. Our theme song is always, as always, is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can also listen to this show and all of our past local talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. Your participation as an audience and your generous donations help make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.